Welcome back. So this is our last lecture today. And what we will do is continue with the singularity theorems for cosmology, and then also a bit of a comment on the case of black holes. So in the previous lecture, we saw a singularity theorem that shows that under certain weak assumptions, the universe should have had or must have had a singularity at its beginning, in the sense that all the geodesics had a beginning, the past geodesics had a beginning somewhere, and cannot be extended. Now, from that, one might conclude, oh, I know what happened. If that's the case, then, well, there was some sort of big bang, and clearly everything just ripped apart at the beginning, and that's the initial singularity. Or is it? You see, with the singularity theorems, we only showed that the geodesics, past extended, end somewhere, have to end somewhere, cannot be extended, and in that sense, we have a singularity. But what type of singularity? If we follow the universe backwards in time, then is it necessarily the case, just because we showed that there's a singularity, is it necessarily the case that just everything got closer together? Or could there be also other singularities? And it turns out there could be other types of singularities. It's not as simple as it just has to be an explosion where everything just ripped apart. I mean, obviously, we can easily think of two possibilities. Namely, one would be that everything started in a point. So for example, if I have an FRW space-time, where every space-like hypersurface, where we can foliate in such a way that every space-like hypersurface is, for example, a sphere, a three-dimensional sphere, then if we follow that back in time to a singularity, then really everything started in a point and then expanded in size from there. So the volume of the universe would have started at zero and then grow from there. But if we consider an FRW cosmology model, where every space-like hypersurface, every equal time slice, is R3, then even if it shrinks in towards the past, it's always R3. Which means that the Big Bang didn't start in a point at zero volume and then the volume increased, but instead the Big Bang was everywhere. And as far as we know, the universe is not finite. I mean, we have no evidence that the universe is finite in size. So this is actually a possibility that even though everything came closer and, I mean, there was a contraction of nearby geodesics, this doesn't mean that they all have to meet in one point. The universe could have started at the Big Bang with an R3 right away, infinite volume to start with. But there are other possibilities, and the singularity theorem that we covered doesn't tell us which singularity it is. Now, to find out what type of singularities it could be, one way to do it is to use high symmetry assumptions, so that we can then solve the Einstein equations explicitly. And then once we have an explicit solution, we can just run it back in time and see what type of singularity we get. So we assume a set of symmetries of matter and space-time, and then we consider exact solutions, or at least their asymptotic behavior as we approach a singularity. And then we choose a time-like congruence of geodesics, as we have done before, but now on the basis of actually having an explicit solution of the Einstein equations. And then we can calculate explicitly for that solution, for that space-time, the twist, the shear, and the expansion. Remember, the twist is the antisymmetric part of this B tensor. It tells us how nearby geodesics will twist around each other. Then the shear tells us that if the geodesics, for example, were arranged in a circle, then that circle might become an ellipsoid, because in one direction it might drift apart, in the other direction it might get together. And then there's the expansion, which is the overall divergence of the geodesics. Now, in this way, we can see how the expansion or the contraction of the universe behaves dynamically in an exact solution with less symmetry than we assumed in the FRW space-times. Now, remember that the expansion in one direction does not necessarily imply that we have an expansion also in another direction, in another direction. In the case, for example, where we do not have an expansion, but a shear, what we have is that whatever expansion we have in one direction is made up for by a shrinkage in the other direction. It's like if you have a rubber ball, you can squeeze it in one direction, but it will expand in the other direction. On the other hand, we also have the ability, or the space-time has the ability to actually expand overall. So let's consider the entire tensor theta mu nu that describes the symmetric part of that B tensor that describes what nearby geodesics are doing. And that consists, if you remember, of the shear part that preserves the overall size of, let's say, a circle or a ball, and it only shears. And then there was the term that is the overall expansion. Remember that the theta mu nu tensor is invariant under the action of the projector onto the space-like part. So this theta mu nu tensor is actually purely space-like. And it is symmetric. By definition, it's symmetric in these indices. Now, whatever is symmetric in these indices and also purely space-like is actually a self-adjoint operator or self-adjoint matrix, because it's only the time components that can mess that up. Remember, as we saw earlier, just because two indices are symmetric in relativity don't mean that your operator is diagonalizable. But if it's space-like too, then yes, because the signature is then well-defined. I mean, it's definite and not indefinite signature as the metric in space-time is. So since it is fully space-like and symmetric, we have that it can be diagonalized in a suitable orthonormal frame. And therefore, this theta mu nu tensor looks like this, 0 and then theta 1, theta 2, theta 3, which are these expansions. If there was only shear, then an increase, a large theta 1 would have to mean a small theta 2 or a small theta 3, etc., so that the trace is constant. And then the overall trace of it is the overall theta. So what we have is that the theta here is the trace of the whole thing. And so it is the theta 1 plus theta 2 plus theta 3. And now we define local Hubble parameters. Now the Hubble parameter tells us how much, at what rate the universe is expanding or shrinking. And here we have it in a more subtle way. We actually have it resolved, the shrinkage or the expansion, in three cardinal directions, namely directions, orthogonal directions, which diagonalize that total expansion tensor. And then we call, and we take this expansion term theta I in the I direction, take a third of it and call that the Hubble parameter in that direction. And then the sum of them is a third of the whole thing here. And why a third? Well, it's because when we take the trace of it, we get a factor of 3 because of the because we have 3 spatial dimensions. So now we use the hi and the h itself to define local directional and general scale factor functions. Remember that in the FRW space-time case, we had a scale factor of A. And then A dot over A was the H. But here we do that for every one of the cardinal directions separately and also overall. So we have an L dot I over Li, Hi, and this is for the overall expansion. And the time derivative is defined with respect to the time-like vector field that we had defined in the previous lecture. So now we can ask, how do these Li behave as we go back in time? How does this Hubble parameter, but it's not just one anymore, it's three of them, how do they behave as we go back in time towards the singularity? And now it's no longer speculative. We use these highly symmetric cases where we can actually find the solutions. And this is the surprising kind of thing that can happen here. First of all, the full set of possibilities hasn't been exhausted yet. We don't know, we don't have a complete classification of how the approach to the initial singularity could be. It depends, of course, on the solution at hand. And we have only highly symmetric actual solutions. But it is expected that there are way more cases than what I will describe now. So explicit examples are known. Explicit examples of exact solutions to the Einstein equations with the suitable matter that obeys the strong energy condition. And then we have the following four cases, four basic cases. And then there are mixed cases and potentially other weird cases. So one situation is obtained for Friedmann, Lemaître, Roberts, and Walker spacetimes, where we have full isotropy and homogeneity. And there we have that all of the Hubble parameters and each of the cardinal directions go to zero. So all of these expansion factors go to zero. That's what we would usually consider to be a Big Bang singularity. That's what most people have in mind intuitively. But it doesn't have to be like that. There are other solutions to the Einstein equations that have less symmetry. And then when you follow, when you trace back in time these parameters here, what you find is that L1 and L2 might go to zero. So it's just like the usual shrinkage, but it could be that L3 actually goes to infinity. And that would be called a cigar singularity because it becomes like, it's like a cylinder here, right? So the whole thing contracts, but maybe one of those directions doesn't actually contract. You still have a singularity because in two directions it contracts like that. You could also have that L1 and L2 go to zero. So again, it's a contraction, but it could be that L3 doesn't even go to infinity. It just goes to a finite size, which actually means a finite length cigar. So the universe would have started as an infinitely thin but finite length cigar, which then exploded. But you could also have, and that would be called a barrel singularity, but you could also have that L1 and L2, let's say, go to a constant, so the universe shrinks, but not more than a certain amount of time, a certain amount of shrinkage for L1 and L2. But L3 goes to zero. In this case, we have that the universe gets pancaked in the L3 direction, right? So it's pancaked in the L3 direction, but L1 and L2 stay finite. So it's really like a pancake. So because it's in two spatial dimensions, it's a finite area, but the thickness goes to zero. And that's a singularity that could also happen. None of this could be excluded. None of these are excluded by the singularity theorems. The singularity theorem only says, well, one of these happens, or weirder cases in which we have mixtures of that. For example, there could be a pancake from which a cigar emanates or something like that. But how do you actually get a solution to the Einstein equations that does that? But the point is, these cases, cigar singularities, barrels, and pancake singularities, are known to actually occur with explicit solutions to the Einstein equations. But that doesn't mean that they are generic, right? Because these are obtained from solutions that are of high symmetry. Now, for homogeneous and isotropic Friedmann, Lemaître, Roberts, and Walker models, of course, what we have is this case where all of the Li go to zero. I'm just saying that on one hand, we have the FRW solution, which has this property that all directions shrink to zero. On the other hand, we have a singularity theorem, we have multiple singularity theorems that tell us that even if we can't solve the Einstein equations exactly, we can prove that under certain conditions, mostly the strong energy condition, in the past, the universe started with a singularity. But that's by no means to say that the singularity is of that form, right? We should expect it is more weird than that. The Big Bang probably wasn't just an explosion in all directions in the same way. Okay, so much about cosmological singularities. Now, what about black holes? Black holes are supposed to have singularities in the middle. Let's collect some of the things that we need to study black holes and their singularities. So in 1915, 108 years ago, Schwarzschild found this black hole solution to the Einstein equation. There are two things to distinguish: the Schwarzschild black hole and the coordinate system, the Schwarzschild coordinate system. They're very different things. The Schwarzschild black hole is a solution to the Einstein equation, and it can be written down in whatever coordinate system you want. Now, Schwarzschild had to choose a coordinate system to represent his solution, and that's the Schwarzschild coordinate system, right? So the Schwarzschild solution in the Schwarzschild coordinate system takes this form here. So that's a metric with these components here. Now that metric has a singularity at r equal to 0. We can see that there's something happening at r equal to 0. And it has a horizon, an event horizon, at r equal to 2m. We see that there's also something happening at r equal to 2m. Because if r is equal to 2m, then we have 1 minus 1 goes to 0. We have the inverse of that, so this thing blows up. Now, the thing is that this is actually singularity. This only looks singular. It is not really singular. This coefficient really does blow up at r equal to 2m, at that radius. But if you calculate curvature invariants, they are all staying finite, all of them. And that indicated, and it took decades to figure that out, but that indicated that maybe there is no singularity, maybe it is just a horizon. And this can be proven by changing coordinates in a clever way, such that the metric is no longer singular in these new coordinates. And it turns out that that can be done, and we will see it in a moment. There are different coordinate systems for the Schwarzschild solution in which there is no singularity of the metric, except at r equal to 0. No matter what coordinate system you choose there, the curvature does blow up. By the way, this is a vacuum solution. The energy momentum tensor for this is 0 everywhere. At r equal to 0, the metric is not defined. It's a singularity, right? So technically, it's a vacuum solution. And it describes not just black holes. It also describes the outside of the moon or the Earth. Whenever you have a matter distribution, then outside of that matter distribution, you have a vacuum solution. And that's the Schwarzschild solution. It can always be applied, whether it is a black hole. In that case, if it's a non-rotating black hole, non-charged, then this is the solution all the way from r equal to 0, excluding r equal to 0 for all possible radii. And for the moon, for example, you would have to choose r to be larger than the radius of the moon so that you are in the vacuum solution part. And then inside the moon, of course, the metric would be a different one from the Schwarzschild metric. But the outside masses, that would be the metric. So the coordinates t, little r, phi, and theta, phi and theta are angles, are called the Schwarzschild coordinates here. Now, the Schwarzschild coordinates are weird and not really that good. They have one advantage, which is that very far away from the matter, for r being really large, R really becomes the distance from the black hole, and T really becomes the time of somebody who flies around far away from the black hole. So that's good. But what if you are somebody who is actually doing business near to a black hole? Then the Schwarzschild coordinates are not that great. And in particular, what we see is that the sign changes, the sign of the coefficients changes in the Schwarzschild metric as we pass through R equal to 2m. See, as we pass through R equal to 2m, this thing changes from positive to negative. This changes from negative to positive, positive to negative as well. So these have a sign change at that point, which means that while outside the black hole, the time coordinate is time-like, inside the black hole, it becomes space-like. So even though it's still called T, it actually, as far as the signature is concerned, is a space-like coordinate, and R becomes a time-like coordinate. So that's a little unusual. It doesn't indicate any interesting physics per se. It just says that T shouldn't be considered a time inside the black hole, because you can read off from the signature of the metric that d by dt is not a time-like vector. D by dt is a space-like vector. And inside the black hole, d by dr is a time-like vector. So for example, consider a traveler, let's call her Alice, who is freely falling from r equal to r naught, somewhere outside the black hole. This is the radius, this is the distance from the black hole center, and this is the Schwarzschild time, so this is Schwarzschild distance, Schwarzschild time. So imagine that Alice, a traveler, is freely falling from this distance r naught at time equal to zero towards the black hole and into the black hole. Then how does that look in Schwarzschild coordinates? Well, in Schwarzschild coordinates, initially, let's say she's at rest. So she's not changing her position, she's only gaining time. That means that her trajectory starts vertically, only gaining time, not getting any closer to the black hole. But of course, the attraction will, the gravitational attraction will attract Alice, and so her trajectory is towards the black hole. So she is getting a smaller radius, a smaller distance from the black hole, while time increases. Now, in Schwarzschild coordinates, her trajectory, you can calculate it, and I wrote it down for you here. These are the exact formulas. The trajectory actually goes like this and forever, which means that it takes an infinite Schwarzschild time for Alice to actually overcome the distance r equal to 2m. Which means that according to Schwarzschild time, she never makes it across the horizon. Of course, she does actually make it across the horizon. According to her wristwatch, she does. And then, according to the Schwarzschild coordinate system, she's actually coming back here from T infinity. And then, for diminishing T, remember, d by dt is a space-like coordinate. It's just called t, but it's not time at all. It's a space-like coordinate. In principle, she could travel like this, back and forth in t, because it's a space coordinate. And then she is traveling here in this direction, r going unavoidably smaller and smaller, because that's now the time direction in this way. The d by dr is a time-like vector, so she's forced to go this way, towards r equal to 0. But in principle, as t is concerned, she could go up and down. So that's her trajectory in the Schwarzschild coordinates. And then, of course, eventually she crashes into r equal to 0. Now, that's not very intuitive here, that there's this spike. So how about we choose a better coordinate system? So what coordinate system might Alice want to choose? Now, first of all, the angles don't really matter as long as Alice is doing her free fall radially, as long as she's not, you know, circling around. So let's try to do this without angular momentum. And by dropping the angular variables, we get an automatic advantage. Because if you remember, in a two-dimensional space-time, the metric can always be written as a scale factor times the Minkowski metric. Right? That's not true in 3 plus 1 dimensions, but in 1 plus 1 dimensions, you can always do that. In 1 plus 1 dimensions, also in 2 plus 0 dimensions, we have that every metric can be written as a scale factor times the flat metric. Right? And remember why that is? It's because the metric in 1 plus 1 dimensions has only, you know, like 3 independent parameters, because it's a 2 by 2 matrix that's symmetric. So it has the 2 entries on the diagonal and one of the off diagonal, and the other off diagonal is already determined. So it has 3 independent parameters. But they're not really independent, because you can choose a coordinate system by choosing new variables, right? So you go from x0, x1 to new coordinates y0, y1. And for that, you choose 2 functions freely, namely y0 as a function of x0, x1, and y1 as a function of x0 and x1. So you have 2 free choices of functions, and you have only 3 parameters in the metric that seem independent. So you can choose your change of coordinates system with 2 free functions in such a way to fix 2 of the parameters in the metric. Right? And so the metric really has only 1 free parameter. And that's very useful, as we will see now. Remember, that was also behind the idea of the Penrose diagrams. Penrose diagrams are possible for any space-time as long as you make it 1 plus 1 dimensional. Otherwise, you can't necessarily do that, right? And and usually we do that just by dropping the angular dependence. So we drop the phi and the theta dependence. And then we say, well, what kind of coordinate system might Alice want? Well, Alice might want this. Let's say Alice says, oh, I'm going to start falling from our node, or perhaps even from directly the horizon, where things get interesting, and then just freely fall. So our node could be chosen to be 2m. And in particular, Alice wants that the metric, according to her preferred coordinate system, should be regular across the horizon. None of this singularity business of the Schwarzschild coordinates. After all, if the Schwarzschild spacetime really doesn't have a singularity there, the curvature doesn't blow up, then it should be possible to find a coordinate system such that the metric has components that are finite across the horizon. Also, she will require that when she starts freely falling, that the metric is eta mu nu. So at the horizon, let's say she starts free falling at the horizon. So basically, we dangle her over the horizon, and then she cuts the cord, and then she falls freely. And so she wants that at her time equal to 0, well, that shouldn't be 0 here. That should be the 2m. It should be just the regular eta mu nu metric. And again, if there is no singularity at the horizon, this should be possible. And then, since we are working in 1 plus 1 dimension now, Alice can have a further demand. That's very, very useful. She says, OK, so now we said that at the horizon, the metric should be finite. It should should be non-singular. It should be proportional to eta mu nu. And further, away from the horizon, the metric should be just a scalar function times the flat metric eta mu nu. In 1 plus 1 dimension, that's always possible by a suitable choice of coordinate system. And she chooses that coordinate system. That has the advantage that in her coordinate system, the light cones are going to be like this, 45 degrees. Right? This is, to the right is for larger r, so outward light rays. And to the left is inward light rays. Right? So it's 45 degrees. That's why it's useful to go to 1 plus 1 dimension, because then we can force a coordinate system, because we know it does exist, such that the metric is just a scalar multiple times eta mu nu. And since it's the usual eta mu nu, we know that light cones are at 45 degrees. Now, it's a lot of work to figure out what that coordinate system is. But here's the outcome of all of that work. Namely, Alice's coordinate system is called the Kruskal, which is called the Kruskal-Szekeres coordinate system, has variables capital T and capital R, and they are related in this way to the little r and the little t. And you see, it can get a little complicated here. Actually, there's a theta function here. These are theta functions, which means that depending on whether you're inside or outside the black hole, it's either this term or that term that applies, or this term or that term that applies. In principle, this mapping is invertible. So we can also get the little t and the little r from capital T and capital R. So the little letters are the Schwarzschild coordinates, and the capital letters are Alice's Kruskal-Szekeres coordinates. OK, so this is the new coordinate system. We can now map all the points of the Schwarzschild coordinate system, like here. We can map all of those points. Remember, the r is positive. We can map all these points to the Kruskal-Szekeres coordinates of Alice. And we can express the metric in the new coordinates. So the metric, so the infinitesimal distance, now takes this form. It's actually dt squared minus dr squared, as we wanted, times some scalar prefactor. We wanted that. You see, this is eta mu nu here. Right? So this is the Minkowski metric, and that's a scalar prefactor. And what if, I should say that in principle, we can, as we said, this is expressing the capital letters coordinates in terms of the little, small cap RT coordinates. In principle, that's invertible, but it's hellishly complicated to do. And however, it does exist, and you can always do that numerically for plotting or even numerical calculation purposes. And here we have little r of capital T, capital R. Very, very complicated formula, but well defined because we have these, and it's just a matter of inverting those. Right? So, because remember, that's the metric in terms of Alice's coordinate system, capital T, capital R. So here we have the metric, the Minkowski metric. And here we have this scalar prefactor. And first of all, we notice that when r is equal to 2m, so at the horizon, there's no singularity here. Right? Because if r is equal to 2m, that just becomes 1. And if r is equal to 2m, this becomes 1. So we have 1 minus 1, it's a 0. So e to the power 0 is 1. So it's just 1 here, as we wanted. We wanted that it's a Riemann normal coordinate system for Alice at the point of release. She sits on the horizon at r equal to 2m, and her coordinate system is this. So notice that we usually think that at the horizon, weird stuff is happening. No, at least according to classical general relativity, nothing weird is actually happening there. You can be right on an event of the horizon and develop a Riemann normal coordinate system, right? And that's what she does here. So you just have these coordinates there. With the conformal prefactor, and this prefactor is 1 on the horizon. On the other hand, the metric really does blow up as r goes to 0. Right? As r goes to 0, there's nothing special here, but you divide by r. So we have a singularity here. And that's a real one that cannot be gotten rid of by change of coordinates, as is clear, because as we calculate the curvature, it actually diverges there. So now, in this coordinate system, how does the situation look? Well, in this coordinate system, capital R is this is the new radius, and we have the new time variable, and Alice's trajectory starts here. She is being released at this point at zero velocity, just dropped into the black hole. This is not actually feasible if you think about it, because even if Alice was holding on to a string, and we are far away, and we hold on to her, right? Then as she approaches the Schwarzschild horizon, we have to pull harder and harder, divergingly hard, right? Divergingly hard. So we cannot actually release her exactly on the horizon because the force there would be infinite. We can release her only a little bit before. Okay, but hypothetically, if an Alice comes into existence, let's say a particle is being created, just happens to be at that event or so, then that would be the trajectory of that particle or that Alice here. So she's not gaining any distance here. She will just gain in time and eventually hit the singularity. But the singularity is not a point here. All of these points are the singularity in this coordinate system. Remember that everything is proportional to the Minkowski metric, so light cones are like this everywhere. Light cones are like this, and the event horizon is here. This is the event horizon. So for example, let's say you're out here, and you want to travel past the black hole, but don't want to fall into it. So you want to be a survivor here, right? So you travel like this. Actually, that I didn't properly draw, because this would mean, you see, this is a 45-degree line. This would be a slope that's shallower. Cannot do this. So you can only go like this. So the best you can do is stay asymptotically close to it. And never, I mean, asymptotic is not even the right word. You can keep a finite gap there, right? But I mean, the best you can do is choose a finite gap and then travel parallel to that event horizon at 45 degrees. That can be a huge distance, right? But in this coordinate system, that's not so obvious. So an observer is careful to not crash into this. And they can do that. I mean, for example, if you are an observer here and you travel outwards at 45 degrees, yeah, you're just not getting any closer to the black hole. On the other hand, if a friend wants to come along for the ride with Alice, yeah, that's easy. You just travel this way, you cross the horizon here, and once you are across that horizon, look at your light cone. No matter what, you're going to end up on the singularity. Now, the Schwarzschild coordinates can be looked at in Alice's coordinate system. So for example, constant Schwarzschild radius are lines like this. These are lines of constant Schwarzschild radius. Right? And as you go closer and closer to this, you have that the Schwarzschild radius goes down. And constant Schwarzschild radius outside is this. So you see, if you travel like that, for example, you can be just hovering over the black hole. That would be hovering over the black hole, constant r. Doesn't look like hovering, but that's what it is. And then the Schwarzschild time are actually these lines. Constant Schwarzschild time is are these lines. Now, Alice can also choose what is called light cone coordinates. Light cone coordinates are obtained by essentially rotating this picture by 45 degrees. You choose new variables, u and v, that are t minus r and t plus r. You obtain that by 45 degrees. If you just think of cosine times this minus sine times that, and then you choose the angle, right, and then you get that. Why would we want to do that? Why do we choose light cone coordinates? I wanted to introduce them now because you might encounter them later, for example, in the course that I teach next term, quantum field theory and curved space-time. There, we will also look at black holes and calculate and derive the Hawking radiation from black holes. And there, it would be very useful to work with the light cone coordinates. And the reason is that the wave equations become very similar in light cone coordinates. And we can see that here in the following way. First of all, if we choose this coordinate system, the u and the v, instead of the t and the r, then geometrically, we're really just rotating this by 45 degrees. That's not a big deal. It's not like we squeeze and stretch things. No, it's just rotating it. But when we do that, then the metric takes this simple form here, where we have no longer dt squared minus dr squared, but we have du dv. That's the only term here, du dv. So it's off diagonal, the metric. And that has a very important consequence, because it means that in these coordinates, we can solve the wave equation completely easily, super easily. Namely, what we obtain is this. The action of the Klein-Gordon field, which is normally written in this way, I mean, it's always written in this way, in whatever coordinate system, that is the action of the Klein-Gordon field, if you remember. Then in Alice's coordinate system, this takes this particular form. And in the coordinate system, in Alice's light cone coordinate system, in Alice's light cone coordinate system, that's the action. So we have a u derivative of phi and a v derivative of phi. And that means that the Euler-Lagrange equations are going to be very simple. We have an Euler-Lagrange equation where we say the derivative, the functional derivative with respect to the du derivative of phi, and then the other derivative, the dv derivative of that, is equal to 0, and the other equation of motion is the same. So the Euler-Lagrange equation, the equation of motion, the Klein-Gordon equation, in 1 plus 1 dimensions, choosing the light cone coordinates, takes this form. And in this form, the Klein-Gordon equation is trivial to solve. Do you see why it's trivial to solve it? Any phi that's a function of v only is solving this equation, right? If it's a function of v only, it's solving it. You get some derivative of v, it's still a function of v only, and then differentiate by u is 0. But also, if it's a function of u only, it's also solving it. And that gives it a complete set of solutions. Any function of v only plus any function of u only is a solution here. And so the quantization of such a simple-to-solve theory is, of course, a breeze. It's relatively easy. And that's why it's being done this way. And then from that, you can then calculate the Hawking radiation quite straightforwardly. as will be discussed next term in my course. And then Bob's choice of coordinate system. So imagine Alice made this choice because she's adventurous and is about to fall into a black hole. So she wants a coordinate system. Remember, her requirements on the coordinate system were these. She said, I want a coordinate system that is not blowing up at the horizon. I want a coordinate system that's just the Minkowski metric at the horizon where I'm starting my trip. And I want that this coordinate system extends to all of the space-time by being the Minkowski metric up to a scalar prefactor everywhere. And the scalar prefactor should be 1 on the horizon where she starts the trip. And then she gets this picture here. And you may wonder, by the way, what about down here? Well, I didn't mention it because it's not part of the black hole. But you can extend the metric into that regime. And then what you get is a white hole. You get a white hole and the space around it. Now, there's been much discussion about this. And white holes could exist in principle. These would be black hole-like things, but sort of time reversed. They can only spit things out instead of receiving anything. But on their own, they're not sustainable because they would just evaporate. They would just not even evaporate. They would just spit stuff out until there's nothing left. But you could imagine a black hole and a white hole together combined into a wormhole. But then that's not what this describes directly, right? It's not describing a wormhole. It's just describes the kind of time-reversed version. And this is not stable. You see, if you perturb that solution, the Schwarzschild solution. You give it angular momentum, or you describe a space-time which develops a black hole, for example, through the infall of spherically perfectly symmetric matter. Then you can describe it in such coordinates, but there's nothing here, right? Because you actually have the infall of matter. And here, this would say that this black hole has a twin, a white hole twin. And there has been much discussion about this, but personally, I agree with Gerard Tuft, who says that this is should be considered as a mirror image of that. So that it's not something new, but it's literally just a mirror image. Whatever happens there, etc. But what it shows us is that we should consider not only, in principle, we should not only consider the black hole solution, but we should keep in mind that by just reversing a few signs, we get a white hole solution too. Schwarzschild also implicitly it discovered a white hole solution, and there might be circumstances such as in the case of wormholes that have an opening where stuff could come out that could be effectively approximately like a white hole. So I don't want to dismiss this completely, but this is far-fetched that there are white holes, except if there are wormholes, but they are hard to, it's hard to see how they could arise in nature. Okay, so now let's see what Bob may want from his coordinate system. Bob is a traveler, an astronaut, who is far away from the black hole and wants to stay far away from the black hole. Then what would Bob's choice of coordinate system be? Well, Bob would say, I want the metric to go to the Minkowski metric far away from the black hole. Obviously, right? Because far away from the black hole, it should be essentially Minkowski space. That's not the case for Alice's choice of coordinates. Of course, her metric does go effectively to Minkowski space. It just doesn't, it's not obvious in her choice of coordinates because her coordinates are so weirdly related to the metric, to the Schwarzschild coordinates or to Bob's coordinates. So what he wants is that far away from the black hole, Bob wants that it becomes obvious that the metric becomes the Minkowski metric. You know, you can always change coordinates so that this metric looks weird far away from the black hole, as Alice does. But Bob wants it to be explicit. The metric becomes this metric far away from the black hole. And Bob says, yeah, and I also, since we are working in 1+1 dimensions, I also want that the coordinate system is chosen such that the metric is taking the form of a scalar prefactor times the Minkowski metric. Because that has the advantage, having just a prefactor times the eta mu nu has the advantage that, again, all the light cones are at 45 degrees like that. And you can immediately tell, okay, this end of the light cone is outgoing light rays. This end of the light cone is ingoing light rays. So then, in his coordinate systems, photons travel at 45 degrees, left or right. And the equations of motion of matter will be simple. Again, because Bob will be able to use light cone coordinates again, and the equations of motion will be simple, etc. Now, Bob's choice of coordinates, once you go through all of the math, turn out to be the tortoise coordinates, T star and R star. And in terms of the Schwarzschild coordinates, T star is T. It's the same as the Schwarzschild time, which tells us immediately that crossing the horizon in Bob's coordinate system, in his tortoise coordinate systems, still takes an infinite amount of time. Which tells us that if you're far away from the black hole, where ordinary Minkowski space rules, it really takes an infinite amount of time to see anybody actually cross the horizon. See, we may not have trusted the Schwarzschild time, but Bob's time is the good one. Because he's choosing a coordinate system such that the metric takes the eta mu nu form far away from the black hole. So the time coordinate of Bob is really the time coordinate of somebody who is at rest, measuring his or her proper time far away from the black hole. But of course, Bob's coordinate system is not exactly the Schwarzschild coordinate system. No, he has this new radial variable r star, which starts at the horizon. So r equal to 0 means we are on the horizon. So it's r minus 2m plus all of this. If r is equal to 0, if r is larger than 2m, then, no, wait, okay. Let me back up a sec. This coordinate system is covering only the outside of the horizon. So for r equal to 2m, that is to say on the horizon, what we have is that r star is actually minus infinity. And that's because r over 2m in this case goes towards 0, so the log of that goes to minus infinity. So r star goes to minus infinity. In principle, again, this change of coordinates is invertible to obtain little r as a function of little r star. However, it only works for the outside of the black hole. So Bob's coordinate system only covers the outside of the black hole. Isn't that interesting? It means that if you choose the metric, if you choose a coordinate system such that the metric tensor takes the form eta mu nu far away from the black hole, and you require that the metric anywhere else is a multiple of the Minkowski metric, then automatically, with these requirements, you can only have a coordinate system that covers the outside of the black hole. And that is that coordinate system. It differs from the Schwarzschild coordinates only by redefinition of the radius, where now the horizon is reached by r going to minus infinity. Now let's look at what the metric looks like in the tortoise coordinates. So what does the Schwarzschild black hole look like then? Well, we required that we get the usual Minkowski metric here. So that's the usual term, up to a conformal prefactor, up to a scalar prefactor. That's what we have here. And then if we plot our Schwarzschild spacetime, that is to say the outside of the black hole, if we plot the coordinate system for the outside of the black hole, then we have a radial variable that runs from minus infinity to plus infinity, a time variable that is the Schwarzschild time, and that is also the proper time for somebody who is sufficiently far away from the black hole. The light cones are again at 45 degrees because that's the shape of the metric. So a traveler can only travel, like this, with the slope being always within the forward light cone. And a traveler who wants to travel into the black hole will have to travel this way, in fact, forever, because the horizon is at r star minus infinity. And that's consistent with our observation earlier, that anybody who actually wants to cross the horizon in the Schwarzschild time takes an infinite amount of time. And the Schwarzschild time is also the tortoise coordinate time. So a geodesic, for example, would be like this. You travel like that, and eventually you travel faster and faster. You travel essentially at 45 degrees, and you travel forever, and you get closer to the horizon without ever reaching it. Now, Bob can again choose light cone coordinates, which are defined as the sum and the difference between the t and the r variables. And then the metric takes again the form, this off-diagonal form here with the du dv, du bar dv bar. And that has the advantage that the Klein-Gordon action, this is the Klein-Gordon action in every coordinate system, this is in the tortoise coordinate system, and this is in the light cone tortoise coordinate system. And you see that it again takes this very simple form. And the equation of motion, the Klein-Gordon equation, that is to say the Klein-Gordon equation takes this form. And again, we can write down the solutions right away. And what we find is that we can quantize it very easily, and then we can study for example, Hawking radiation. In order to derive the Hawking radiation, we actually have to use both coordinate systems, Alice's and Bob's, because both are useful for understanding part of the physics. And we quantize the quantum field theory in Alice's coordinate system, we quantize the quantum field theory in Bob's coordinate system, and then there's a unitary transformation between them, and working that out, one can then derive the existence of Hawking radiation. Now, do black holes exist and possess a singularity? Well, there is a, in principle, you can have a look at the black hole. Not from here, though. You would have to travel to the southern hemisphere, or maybe the equator. Maybe you can see it from India as well. I'm not sure. But you see, on the northern hemisphere, we can't see the center of the galaxy. If you look out there, can't see it, just because of the tilt of the Earth. Don't worry, if you don't want to go to the southern hemisphere to see the center of the galaxy, where the black hole at the center of our galaxy is, you can also wait 200 million years, because that's how long it takes for the solar system to make an orbit around the center of the galaxy. So it's actually 100 million years. Then you're on the other end, and then you have a clear view of the center of the galaxy. In any case, so at the center of the galaxy, in the constellation Sagittarius, there is this black hole A star, Sagittarius A star. It has about 4 million stellar masses, a diameter, that is to say the Schwarzschild radius, 2m is 44 million kilometers. It's 26,000 light years away from us, not that far away, right? right at the center of the Milky Way. Now, in the meantime, that black hole has also been observed, but the first black hole that was observed was that of a neighboring galaxy M87 by the Event Horizon Telescope, and some of the people here at PI were involved in this. Observations in the millimeter radio wave band with enough resolution to essentially see something like the shadow of the black hole. You don't really see the event horizon. In fact, the notion of event horizon is a difficult one observationally, because in principle you need an infinite amount of time to then define what is an event horizon. We will see that in a minute. But in any case, you've all seen that picture, right? So there's good evidence that there are black holes, even though, of course, it's being probed vigorously whether there are other explanations for all of these things as well. So now, what about the event horizon of a black hole? Remember that the event horizon is defined as the boundary of the causal past of the future infinity of an observer, right? So an observer has to travel forever, and then you look at what could possibly ever have affected that observer. So that's the causal past of that observer. And the boundary of that is the event horizon. So for example, whatever falls into a black hole and cannot come out will not affect anybody who lives outside the black hole, because it just can't come outside. So it's beyond the horizon of somebody who travels towards the future forever without going into the black hole. But you see, the forever part is difficult in cosmology. Even though we're dealing with billions of years, that's nowhere near forever. And in principle, black holes could also disappear. They can grow, they can shrink. So event horizon is maybe not the right notion here. And for the purpose of doing what we did for cosmology, namely defining defining a theorem, proving a theorem that shows that there has to be a singularity inside the black hole, similar to how we discussed there are conditions that allow us to infer that there has to be a singularity at the beginning of the universe. For that purpose, the notion of event horizon is not that useful. There are other notions that are being used in that case. And they're a little bit more subtle. So how should we model the properties of real black holes roughly? And again, the strategy is we want to make definitions and considerations that can be applied even when we don't have exact solutions. Because this thing is, whatever it is, it's not a Schwarzschild black hole. It's for sure going to have some charge, some magnetic field, some electric field. It's going to have some spin, some angular momentum, probably a lot of it. So it's not anywhere close to any one of our idealized solutions with a lot of symmetry. There are solutions, of course, black hole solutions that are not Schwarzschild, that have spin and charge and so on. But even they are too symmetric to describe an actual black hole. So again, what we need is a general dictionary of definitions that describe things, and then we can hope to develop singularity theorems, as Penrose did, singularity theorems that work in general, even if you don't have the exact solutions, but you only have conditions on certain properties for which hopefully we make good definitions. So let's look at these terms that need to be defined for that purpose. Singularity theorems, which are suitable for black holes, involve not the concept of event horizon, but the concept of a trapped surface and assumptions related to trapped surfaces. For that, we need a few definitions. First, let's let sigma be a space-like hypersurface. Space-like hypersurface is like a snapshot in time, right? So that's a space-like hypersurface. It's three-dimensional. Now, let's consider T to be a two-dimensional compact smooth space-like submanifold of sigma. So that means it's actually a surface, actually two-dimensional. Something like a sphere around a black hole or a sphere in a black hole. And then we can consider geodesics that go towards that two-dimensional surface T, or that come out of it, or come away from it, ingoing and outgoing. We can look in particular at the null geodesics, the ones that travel the fastest. So we're looking at ingoing and outgoing future-directed null geodesics. In light cone language, it means the right branch, the right edge of the light cone, and the left edge of the light cone. Because the right edge of the light cone is light traveling outwards for r that gets larger, and the left one is for r that gets smaller. Right? So it's not like this and that are in and out. It's like this and that are in and out. Right? Because the time direction is also involved, so that's why it's a 45 degree there. I mean, if the metric is such that light cones are at 45 degrees, but it's always, that's what is meant, the increase in R or decrease in R. All right, so we started with sigma being a space-like hypersurface that's three-dimensional, and then we look at a two-dimensional actual surface, not a hypersurface, but a two-dimensional actual surface. We call it surface because it's two-dimensional, which is a submanifold of sigma, such as, you know, the sigma could be the black hole space-time at one point in time. And then the T could be a sphere around the black hole, it's two-dimensional, at that point in time. And then we consider the ingoing and the outgoing future-directed null geodesics that are orthogonal to that two-dimensional surface. Now, it can happen that these geodesics possess negative curvature in both directions, normally only in one direction. So if we have a sphere outside the black hole, or for that matter outside the moon, because remember that the Schwarzschild solution is a vacuum solution, it also describes the moon, except that it doesn't describe the proper metric inside the moon, but outside it is that. So if you take a sphere around a black hole or around the moon, or some finite distance away from it, then if you look at geodesics that are ingoing for smaller r, and geodesics that are outgoing, then you find that they would have an expansion outwards, but a shrinkage inwards. But it can also happen that you have a trapped surface in which the expansion is negative in both directions. And that's for an example of that would be all of the r equal to constant surfaces inside a Schwarzschild black hole. You see, if you are anywhere here on this constant r surface inside the black hole, then your light cone, let's say if you're here, your light cone is like this. And no matter whether you go left or right on that light cone, you're going to end up on that singularity here. Right? Or maybe it's easier to see on a Penrose diagram. Remember the Penrose diagram of a Schwarzschild black hole? So here, for example, this could be describing the formation of a Schwarzschild black hole. So let's say we have a sphere of dust. And there's enough dust such that when this sphere contracts, at some point, the mass of the sphere leads to a Schwarzschild horizon that is larger than the radius of the sphere. That means that a black hole has formed. And if the dust has a certain radius, that radius will shrink, and the trajectory on the Penrose diagram is this one. And at this point here, from that point onwards, we have that the Schwarzschild radius is larger than the radius of the sphere. So at that point, we have a black hole, and the sphere keeps contracting at that point. And even if some dust particle wanted to escape, it couldn't, because it is here. And if it now wanted to move outwards, well, good luck. You know, you can only go this way at most as shallow as 45 degrees or a bit steeper. Or you could just go inwards. It doesn't matter. You have a contraction of the geodesic. This is just one geodesic, but you could draw multiple geodesics, and you would find that no matter whether you go this way or that way, the geodesics have negative expansion. So they contract. So now let sigma be a space-like hypersurface, as we discussed. And we look at, in that space-like hypersurface, we consider all of the trapped surfaces. That is to say, all of the two-dimensional surfaces which have the property that the expansion is negative no matter which direction you go, left or right, or I mean, trying to go outwards or trying to go inwards. So for example, you take all of the trapped surfaces inside the black hole. And you take the union of all of those. The union of all of those trapped surfaces of inside the black hole would be the trapped region. Because if you're anywhere in there, your geodesics will be contracting. So you're heading towards the singularity no matter what. I mean, when I say you're heading towards the singularity no matter what, I'm kind of implying that we already have a singularity theorem for black holes. For the moment, I'm just saying that no matter where you are, within the trapped region of sigma, parallel geodesics will get closer. The expansion is negative. Okay, so what we do is we take a space-like hypersurface that is a moment in time, and then we look at all those two-dimensional surfaces which have negative expansion in all directions, which are these trapped surfaces. And the union of all of those is the trapped region. And that would be like the inside of a black hole, for example. And then the boundary of that, remember, the trapped region is the region of all those places where you better not be, because there it's going to be a shrinkage no matter which way you go, right? That's the trapped region. And the boundary of that trapped region tells you, you know, don't go further than this, otherwise you're in a trapped region. So the boundary of that trapped region is called the apparent horizon. If you're outside of that, you're fine. You can still have contracting and diverging geodesics, but if you're in it, you only have converging geodesics. So that apparent horizon is two-dimensional. Now, if we foliate the entire space-time into space-like hypersurfaces, remember here we took one space-like hypersurface, one moment in time, and then we looked at all the two-dimensional subsurfaces, which are trapped surfaces. We looked at the union of those, that was the trapped region. Remember, all of this is at one point in time, right? It's a trapped region. And then the boundary of that was the apparent horizon. And now we say, okay, but we can take not just one space-like hypersurface, we can also choose another space-like hypersurface, another space-like hypersurface. We can foliate space-time into a succession of space-like hypersurfaces. So one snapshot of space-time at one time, another snapshot of space-time at another time, and so on. So we parameterize the sigma with alpha such that as we run through all possible values of alpha, we build up the entire space-time. Then for each choice of alpha, for each snapshot, for each moment in time, what we have is an apparent horizon. And then we can consider the union of all of those apparent horizons throughout the history of the universe. And then that union is called the trapping horizon of the space-time. Basically, what it means is that better stay out of the apparent horizon, but the apparent horizon can be different from time to time to time to time. If you want to be safe, just always stay out of the trapping horizon, because that's the accumulation of all those places that you better should not be in at any time. So to check for the existence of an event horizon, I'm just repeating why we go all the way to define the trapping horizon. In order to check for the existence of an event horizon, what do we need to do? We take the world line of an observer, go to future time-like infinity of that observer, and then look at J minus, the causal past of that observer, and then the boundary of that, that's by definition the event horizon of that observer. It's the boundary of that set of events that could have possibly ever affected our observer. But since this, by definition, requires knowledge of the future forever, this is a shaky definition, especially considering that black holes might evaporate away eventually. In contrast, if we want to check for the existence of an apparent horizon, it's something else that we need to do. We don't need to look at an observer that travels forever. To check for apparent horizons, we just need to calculate the expansion and see whether the expansion is always negative. And when that is negative in both directions. And that indicates the existence of an apparent horizon. And that's a local thing that we can calculate. So it's much easier to check that one. And also, it is not teleological. You know, teleological means that in order to say what is now, you have to know all of the future. And that's the case for event horizons, but this is not teleological. This is something that you can check on the spot. On the other hand, the notion of apparent horizon is dependent on how you slice space-time into space-like hypersurfaces. This is a non-trivial business. But there are preferred slicings that we may want to adopt, of course. Just like, you know, FRW space-times have a preferred slicing. Now, you may wonder how these notions are related. How are apparent horizons and event horizons related? Now, quite non-trivially is the answer. Quite non-trivially, in the case of an eternal Schwarzschild black hole, it's quite easy. For an eternal Schwarzschild black hole, the event horizon and the apparent horizons coincide. they're the same, but it just happened to be the same. But in general, they don't they are not necessarily the same. In general, they are not the same. And the singularity theorems of Penrose and others for black holes make assumptions about apparent horizons rather than making assumptions about event horizons. So it's not really about if we have, is there a singularity beyond the event horizon? It's more like, is there a singularity beyond the apparent horizon? And if you think about it, it's actually similar to what we did before for cosmological singularities. Because there, the assumption was that the extrinsic curvature is such that the universe is, at the point in time, it has to be shrinking if you look further back in time, or it has to be expanding, right? So we said, if the universe is expanding everywhere by a certain minimum amount of time, at a certain minimum rate, then we can extrapolate backwards the Einstein equations, assuming the strong energy condition. Then even if we don't know what the exact solutions are, the Einstein equation, together with this initial condition about the expansion rate, allow us to tell, to conclude that there has to be a starting point to each of the geodesics in the past, and therefore there has to have been a singularity. And there was never any mentioning of the existence of a cosmological horizon, for example. It didn't come up. And for a black hole too, it's not the event horizon that determines whether or not a singularity forms. It's, again, it's something about, it's a condition on the apparent horizons, it's a condition on the shrinkage or the expansion of nearby geodesics that leads to the formation of a singularity, as one might imagine, right? So the singularity theorems say, if you have, you know, these apparent horizons, then using the Einstein equations, using energy conditions, you can show that even if you don't know the exact solution, a singularity should form. And maybe a last comment. The issue of Hawking radiation is quite non-trivial, and the general understanding today is that, I mean, not everybody agrees on this, but Hawking radiation is usually thought of not as arising from the event horizon, but from apparent horizons. And that makes a difference. For example, George Ellis, co-author with Hawking on the book on GR and cosmology, he holds that, I'm not sure if I can agree with this, but just to tell you, he says that Hawking radiation can be calculated as a tunneling process. Not everybody calculates it this way, but if you calculate it as a tunneling process out of the horizon, not the event horizon, but the apparent horizons, so as a quantum tunneling process, then he says, well, if you have a static Hawking black hole, then what that means is that you need a tunneling process over light-like distances, which is possible, but a little difficult because it has to be really fast. If the black hole is shrinking fast, then actually that apparent horizon is going to be time-like. And so what you have is an enhanced radiation. If, on the other hand, the black hole is growing, then the tunneling process would have to be over space-like distances, which is forbidden by causality. So he even holds that cosmological or astrophysical black holes don't even radiate. They don't have any Hawking radiation at all because they're growing. See, all the black holes that we see are growing. And the reason is that their Hawking radiation is really, really cold. The typical wavelength of Hawking radiation is the size of the horizon, of the event horizon. So if the black hole has a 2m of like the sun of a few kilometers, then it means that if the sun was a black hole, its Hawking radiation would have a typical wavelength of a few kilometers, which means very, very cold, right? The sunlight, for example, has 6,000 Kelvin in temperature, and its typical wavelength is like 500 nanometers. It's right there in the middle, and it's in green, right? 500 nanometers. And you can imagine how much colder a black hole of the mass of the sun would be, because the wavelength would not be 500 nanometers, but more like 5 kilometers. So by, it's extremely cold. And huge black holes at the centers of galaxies, like in our galaxy, Sagittarius A, should have, should be radiating Hawking radiation at a typical wavelength of the size of millions of kilometers, right? That's almost the DC. It's just, it's extremely low wavelength, extremely low energy. It's just very, very, very cold. In comparison, the cosmic microwave background is 3 Kelvin. It's full of photons. And so any astrophysical black hole that has a Hawking temperature that is colder than 3 Kelvin will actually grow, because it will get, at the very least, even if it doesn't have any hydrogen clouds to feed on, or planets or stars, it will feed on the cosmic microwave background radiation, therefore grow and therefore get colder. And therefore, by Ellis's calculation, and it's very hard to do calculations of Hawking radiation in a non-equilibrium circumstance where the black hole is either shrinking or growing. But if he's right, they're not even radiating at all. Right? So it could still be that eventually black holes radiate away. But that's only after the universe has diluted so much that there's basically that the CMB radiation is so cold that it's colder than the coldest black holes, so that they can actually start actually radiating stuff away. Anyway, so that's the math that's needed for these calculations. And the next term will be quantum field theory on curved space-time for cosmology and for black holes, mostly cosmology, where we won't need actually that much of GR for that. But we need an understanding of GR, but not actually that much of the math. We need the math that we did today with the light cone coordinates and so on, but I will introduce that all in great detail, of course. Right, so that's as far as we get in this course. Thank you very much for attending. Thanks.